This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. 80% of people who die in the United States are on Medicare, so end-of-life policies are a crucial part of the Medicare system. The Affordable Care Act led to a number of significant changes to Medicare's end-of-life policies. Some of them went into effect at the beginning of this month. Now, for the first time ever, physicians can be paid to discuss end-of-life issues with their patients. And the payment system for hospice care has been updated for the first time in more than three decades. My guest today is an expert on end-of-life policy and has spent the past few years looking at what people want from their end-of-life care. Don Taylor is a professor of public policy at Duke University and joins me now. Don, welcome back. Good to have you here.
And thanks for having me.
You say that Medicare is inherently kind of an end-of-life business. What do you mean by that?
Well, the only thing everybody listening today is inevitably going to do is die. And the Medicare program picks up health insurance coverage when we reach 65. And so the insurer for people who are elderly are inherently in the end-of-life business. And so if you're talking about end-of-life policy, you're talking about Medicare policy.
What are the changes that go into effect this month?
So hospice benefit was created in Medicare in 1982, and it has had a per diem payment rate, meaning a fixed amount of money each day paid to a hospice. And then the hospice worked out the care plan for a patient. And what starting on this past just, you know, 2 weeks ago, Medicare has gone to a two-tiered per diem. Higher payments for the first 60 days of hospice, lower payments for days after that, with retrospective enhancements for the last 7 days of life. So it's created essentially a U-shaped, higher early in the hospice stay, a little higher late in the hospice stay, with lower payments in the middle. And so that's the first time, as you say, that we've changed.
Wait, and what's the point of that?
So there are really two policy issues. One is really short periods of hospice use. So like one in four people who use hospice use it for less than 5 days. And most docs will tell you that's not enough time for them to get the good they might get out of hospice. So one goal is increase really short stays. But the policy problem or the issue that's had more attention is really long stays. So when a doc says you're eligible for hospice, what they're saying is they believe you're going to die within 6 months. 10-12% of people on hospice, though, are staying for longer than six months, longer than 180 days. Mm. And the really long lengths of stay have gotten longer and longer. And that has led to the second problem, which is worries that some really long hospice use is inappropriate or perhaps fraudulent. So the big picture goal of the payment was to do something to disincentivize some of the really long hospice stays.
So you're going to have to try to be a little more careful. Obviously, this is a very difficult business in predicting when the end of life will come. But you're asking everybody to be a little bit more careful about making that judgment so that there aren't these long, long stays. Is that part of it?
That's part of it. I think the change that has come about, just having any change was a tremendous move ahead. And we'll probably, my guess would be, you know, anytime you have a new change of something that's been stable for 30 years, yeah, there's almost certain to be unintended consequences. So I think it would be sort of Pollyannish to assume this policy change is magically going to increase right. The short ones and decrease the really long ones. But it's a step towards moving in that direction.
Interestingly enough, we've just had this kind of patient and comfortable conversation about it. But a couple of years ago, this was part of the death panel conversation, wasn't it?
Yes. So the second big thing that Medicare started doing on January 1, 2016 was paying physicians for advanced care planning. And that's payments to physicians to talk with their patients and their loved ones about what are their preferences, what do they want, what are their goals for their days left on earth, essentially. And in 2009, there was a small provision in the Affordable Care Act that was going to do this exact thing, and it was labeled death panels. And, you know, it really set end-of-life policy back quite a lot. Interestingly enough, Medicare this past summer proposed to the normal rulemaking process to create advanced care planning. And whenever you do that, you have an opening for comments. And we pulled all the comments, like over 4,000 comments. And about 80% of them were completely non-germane. They had nothing to do with the topic at hand at all. Of the germane comments, about 90% of them were positive. So I think it's instructive that what was such a political firestorm, you know, August 2009, really was created without much fanfare in 2015-16. And that's good news that maybe the country's ready to get back to a reasoned discussion of this topic.
Yeah, it's obvious when people elevate something like that to descend something like this into a political rhetoric, when it's such an important topic and yet you can turn it into such mindless hash,
yes.
it becomes hard to think about. But what are we thinking about? Because I think about end-of-life planning. I mean, isn't this the kind of conversation patients are having with their doctors? What's different about this?
It's a great question. And the short answer is we really are not sure exactly what has been happening. Further, we're not sure how this is going to change it. And we, for example, at Duke, this policy change came about very quickly. So there wasn't a lot of time to plan evaluation studies. But we have what I would call a quick and dirty evaluation attempt that we've just started at Duke to try to see what docs were doing before with their patients and what they're doing after. There's some skeptics that are saying, I think it's $89 for a 30-minute discussion and then up to $75 more for the next 30 minutes. And they're saying, depending on what kind of physician this is, what their practice is like, this may or may not be enough to change things. It's possible this will turn out to be more symbolic than anything else, but we really just don't know.
Well, what kind of questions do people have that they'd want at this moment and kinds of, and are doctors the ones to answer it, or is it their insurance company that has the answer to this?
Yes, that's a good question. I think a good conversation with someone who's, maybe actively facing the end of life might be, what are your hopes? What are you scared of? What do you want to be able to do tomorrow? What would you like to be able to do next week? And I think it's focused on not being consumed about the dying, but how are you going to live? And so I think that the medical system generally is set up to try to extend life. And it's just starting the conversation to try to figure out when is the patient and the patient's family ready to shift gears and say, we maybe have concluded that life extension, there's not so much we can do. Let's now try to focus on how are we going to maximize the living that I've got left to do. And it's a fair point about, because some docs, in fact, we've done a survey that we're just getting the results back now, asking about advanced care planning. And a goodly proportion of the docs are saying things like, this isn't my thing. I'm not sure how to have this conversation. And I think that's a fair point. They're not taught about this. So this is just part of the story. Like creating payments to have discussions is not going to fix everything. There's a big societal and cultural responsibility to learn how to talk about this.
Well, and it could drive some kind of training that could actually work its way into the medical field. But then the question is, what do patients want?
Yes.
And you've actually researched some of that.
Yeah, we did a project at the DCRI at Duke where we enrolled patient Medicare beneficiaries with advanced cancer. And these are people who the notion of their death was not theoretical. They were really facing this reality. And we put them in groups of 10 to 12 and also with loved ones and had them talk about what was important to them. And we further gave them a theoretical resource constraint. We said, if you could not have everything that the Medicare benefit package pays for, what would you pick? What's most important to you? And we actually found that some of them, between 40 and 50% of them, said things like they were willing to have less, what you might think of as last-ditch chemotherapy treatments in return for what you might call high-touch, low-tech, long-term care services, somebody to help somebody live in their home in an independent, means. What's called concurrent palliative care, which means starting to have hospice-like services before you have unelected curative treatments.
Which is something, by the way, if I can stop you there, that's another change.
The third change in the Medicare program is the Affordable Care Act created the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation studies. And there's something, it's the Medicare Choices model just started on January 1st. And that's about 50 hospice providers nationally are being allowed to enroll patients for hospice and have the patients not have to unelect curative care. Now in traditional hospice, part of the deal is you're saying, I will take hospice in lieu, I will forego quote unquote curative care. And this demonstration project is saying, if we let patients start to have hospice-like service early, services earlier, will that change how they choose to live and the care they choose to get down the road?
Well, it feels like an emotional halfway house. I mean, the difficult thing about choosing hospice is you have just declared that it's over for you, and that's a hard declaration for people to make. So not having to make the hard declaration, but experiencing what hospice care is like and imagining what the counseling is and having that may make that transition easier. Was that part of the thinking?
It is part of the thinking. And for some people, the bright line choice between curative and not and having to unelect quote-unquote curative is they're just not ready to do that. And I say quote-unquote curative because, if a doc could cure somebody, they'd cure them and we'd have a party, get a cake, and invite all our friends over. What that really meant when hospice was created was all the really expensive stuff. And hospice in the early 80s was really sold as not only a choices approach, but as a way to reduce spending. So there's always been that dual focus. And that's part of why there have been some controversies, because anytime you're talking about the money, then some folks are worried that, that's the main focus.
Well, we'll be able to study it and see what impact it has. And Don, thank you so much for this update right now. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Don Taylor, a professor of public policy at Duke Sanford School. You can find out more about his research and recent changes at End of Life Policy at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we look at the power of images and whether or not MLK is still a strong civil rights icon in the post-print era. We'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.